Hello, listeners. It's the first Monday of the month, and this is the monthly news and information bulletin for members and friends of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia, Incorporated, presented by VK3OTN. Greetings to you all. My friend Bruce, VK3UV, will not be joining us this month as he has been at the Gold Coast at the WIA convention, of which I hope you are all aware. As Vice President of RAOTC, he was representative at the luncheon given by the WIA for presidents and secretaries of various clubs in attendance. Hopefully, he will give us a summary of the events of the WIA AGM in the next broadcast. I fear that this means you will have to put up with me for most of this program. But don't despair. There are several items of club business, and I do especially plead with you to listen carefully as these affect you. At the last committee meeting, there was considerable discussion on a variety of issues. One of these was the composition of the committee for the 2018-2019 year. In view of my retirement from RAOTC activities at the AGM, it was recommended that A. The size of the committee be kept to 8 people. As there are 8 people already, there really are no vacancies on the existing committee. However, it was decided B, to call for nominations for any committee positions and that these should be in the hands of the secretary by the next committee meeting on the 16th of August 2018. This means that if you would decide to nominate, you should do it now. And C, any new nominees should present themselves to the existing committee members and state what skills they feel that they could bring to the committee. It would not be good enough to say that you have been an amateur for X number of years. Apart from the committee positions, of which there aren't really any, there are some positions available. These are broadcast officer, in which you would be tasked with the finding and recording of suitable material each month, also finding someone to relay the programs into VK3REC in Melbourne. The QSO party manager, requiring some work in May, August and September, and a recorder of OTN audio. This involves recording the journal each issue and posting it to the various people who receive it. If you would like some help discovering what is involved with these positions, please feel free to ask either Bruce or me now. We would be happy to help, and even more happy to ease someone into the roles rather than leave it until the end of the year and let you find your own way. Again, any nominations for these positions should be in the hands of the secretary by the August meeting, and please get in touch with us via the club email. Another issue discussed was the relays on HF for this broadcast. Over the years, conditions have varied with the sunspot cycles and have resulted in good to poor numbers of callbacks. At present, conditions on 40 and 20 metres are exceedingly poor and the numbers of callbacks on those bands are quite small, never amounting to more than 10% of club members. We therefore invite your input as to whether it is worth continuing with these relays. We would be very grateful if you would indicate, especially in the 40 and 20 metre callbacks, if you feel that these relays should continue beyond September or October this year. I stress that this will not affect the 2-metre and 160-metre broadcasts in Melbourne or VK6, unless listeners would prefer to download this broadcast from the club webpage, and we get some help with the broadcast for the future. Here again, we would welcome your feedback. New members. This month, we welcome two new members. Nick Vitalone, VK6NA. Previous call sign VK6PNJ and VK6UM. Nick became member number 1745. Welcome to you, Nick and John, and please enjoy your time with us. Your support is most appreciated. I am sorry to say that this month there are two SK members, and it is with great sadness that we announce the passing of Duncan Baxter, VK3LZ, RAOTC member number 1251, early in May 2018. You may remember that Duncan was a stalwart of ICOM for many years. He lived and breathed the hobby, so he will be sorely missed by us all. Also, it is with sadness that we have been advised that Jim Griffiths, VK2BGG, RAOTC life member number 1271, became a silent key in February of this year, just before his 91st birthday. Let us pause a moment in memory of our departed colleagues. Thank you. Our first talk this month is on radioactivity. What is radioactivity? Well, any amateur may say, oh, it's what we do when we go into our shacks and turn on our gear. However, we also know that the normally accepted term radioactivity is a source of immense energy with a long and dangerous history. Here's a little article which I found recently from Lauren Fuge, an Adelaide-based science writer. We owe the discovery of radioactivity to bad weather. French physicist Henri Becquerel was trying to study fluorescence, a phenomenon where certain materials glow when exposed to sunlight. But overcast days thwarted his experiments, and so he wrapped his fluorescing uranium salts in cloth and left them in a drawer, along with a photographic plate and a copper cross. This simple serendipitous accident in 1896 revealed the existence of radioactivity, a phenomenon that opened a window into the subatomic world and kick-started the nuclear revolution. When he finally fetched the salts, Becquerel found that an image of the cross had appeared on the photographic plate, even though the salts had not been exposed to light. Quote, I am now convinced that uranium salts produce invisible radiation even when they have been kept in the dark, end of quote, he wrote after conducting further experiments. Becquerel's doctoral student, Marie Curie, investigated the matter with her husband Pierre, and they realized the effect had nothing to do with fluorescence, instead discovering that certain materials naturally emit a constant flow of energy. They coined the term radioactivity and also found two new radioactive elements, polonium and radium. For this profound and exciting work, Becquerel and the Curies received the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1903. Physicists Ernest Rutherford and Frederick Soddy delved deeper and found that tiny amounts of matter contain huge reserves of energy. they also realised that in the process of radioactive decay, one element can turn into another. An atom of uranium can transform via a few intermediate steps into an atom of lead. Around the world, people assumed that these miraculously energetic materials could be put to good use. Until the 1920s, many manufacturers of laxatives and toothpaste proudly laced their products with radioactive thorium, and radioactive substances were only banned in consumer products in the US in 1938. Today we have a much more comprehensive understanding of what radioactivity is, how it can be dangerous, and how we can use it. Here's a basic rundown. Imagine an atom composed of a cloud of electrons around the central nucleus, where particles called neutrons and protons are crammed in together. Some arrangements of protons and neutrons are more stable than others. If there are too many neutrons compared to protons, the nucleus becomes unstable and falls apart. This decay releases nucleic radiation in the form of alpha particles, beta particles, and gamma radiation. An alpha particle carries off two protons and two neutrons, and since an element is defined by its number of protons, the parent atom becomes a whole new element when an alpha particle is emitted. In beta decay, a neutron transforms into one proton and one electron, and the electron speeds off, leaving an extra proton behind and once again resulting in an atom of a different element. Alongside either of the above particles, decaying nuclei can also produce gamma rays, a high-energy electromagnetic radiation. As Becquerel and the Curies discovered, radioactivity is a naturally occurring phenomenon. Many minerals in the earth emit a slow and steady trickle of radiation. The air we breathe contains radioactive gases, and even foods and our bodies contain a small percentage of radioactive atoms like potassium-40 and carbon-14. The earth also receives radiation from the sun and as high-energy cosmic rays. These sources create a natural but unavoidable level of background radiation. Many artificial sources add to this, including medical procedures such as X-rays, smoke detectors, building materials, and combustible fuels. We generally aren't harmed by low-level background sources of radiation, as the extent of harm depends on the length and level of exposure. Radiation can damage the body's internal chemistry, breaking up chemical bonds in our tissue, killing cells, and damaging DNA, which may lead to cancer. In very high doses, radiation can cause sickness and death within hours. The effects of radioactivity have been felt on an even grander scale with the meltdown of nuclear power plants throughout history. The radioactive process of fission has been harnessed for several decades to produce electricity. The nucleus of an atom is split, creating at least two daughter nuclei and releasing energy as heat. The heat is used to boil water to create steam, turning a turbine and generating electricity. Unfortunately, this isn't a clean process. It produces radioactive waste that is difficult to dispose of safely, and in extreme cases, reactions can spiral out of control, such as the disaster triggered by an earthquake at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power station in 2011. Another radioactive process could provide a safe way to generate clean energy, fusion. In contrast to fission, fusion involves joining two atomic nuclei together. This process also releases energy. It's the exact process occurring in the Sun and other stars. But fusion requires extremely high temperatures and pressures, which are expensive and difficult to recreate on Earth. Becquerel died 12 years after his initial discovery at age 54, with burns and scars likely from handling radioactive material. And Marie Curie died several decades later from leukemia. Radiation was probably slowly killing Pierre Curie too, although it's difficult to know as he was fatally run down by a carriage in 1906. Today, our greater understanding of radioactivity allows us to use it much more safely. Accidents with radioactive materials have decreased in frequency and produce fewer fatalities due to stringent safety measures and thorough emergency responses. In the most recent nuclear disaster at Fukushima, no deaths resulted from radiation exposure, but there's still a long way to go before we can safely harness the immense raw power of radioactivity. You are listening to the monthly news and information bulletin for members and friends of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club, presented by VK3OTN. For our second talk this month, you know that from time to time I like to bring you news of women who have made a significant contributions, but who are not necessarily well known. If that makes me a feminist supporter, then so be it. I bring you this week news of a lady in her time was very well known. One of the 20th century's greatest chemists once worked in the food industry. Luckily, her talents weren't restricted to testing sandwich spreads. Think of leukemia, and the subject of mayonnaise doesn't immediately spring to mind. Yet, had fate not intervened, one of the most important researchers into the nature and treatment of blood cancer might today be known, if at all, as simply a master of mayonnaise. Gertrude Bell Ellion was born in New York City in 1918. Her father had been a child immigrant from Lithuania, and her mother had arrived, aged 14, from Russia in 1914. When Gertrude was born, her parents were comfortably off, mainly because her father, Robert, had built up a healthy dental practice. Quote, "My first 7 years were spent in a large apartment in Manhattan, where my father had his dental office with our living quarters adjoining it," end of quote, she later recalled. In 1929, however, life for the Ellion family took a big turn for the worse when they lost most of their money in the Wall Street crash. This limited Gertrude's options for further education after high school, but fortunately she gained admission at the age of 15 to a nearby free college on the back of her good grades. Her grandfather's death from cancer spurred her choice to major in chemistry. After graduating from college, she had no means to pay to attend graduate school, and her employment prospects were bleak. Work was scarce for everyone during the Great Depression, and many potential employers could not accept the idea a woman could be a good scientist. She scored several stints of unpaid and temporary work as a lab assistant, then switched to relief high school teaching while also studying at nights in her quest for a master's degree in chemistry. Then World War II broke out, and suddenly, with men joining the fighting forces en masse, many more jobs became available to women. Ellion gave up the world of freelance science teaching and took a job with food manufacturer Quaker Made. Her responsibilities included testing the acidity of pickles and making sure egg yolk going into mayonnaise was the right colour. There she may have remained, had not her ever curious mind driven her to seek new challenges. In 1944, she found a position as a biochemist at the research laboratories of Burroughs Wellcome, which would later become GlaxoSmithKline Pharmaceutical Company. She would remain with the company even after officially retiring in 1983 until her death in 1999 at the age of 81. Along the way, she would win the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1988. The prize, shared with colleagues James Black and George Hitchings, was awarded in recognition of research that, to quote the citation, demonstrated differences in nucleic acid metabolism between normal human cells, cancer cells, protozoa, bacteria, and virus. The trio's discoveries went far further than simply establishing the ways in which different cells operate. They put their findings to work and created several critically important drugs, saving millions of lives. Ellion played a central role in the development of thioguanine, the 6-mercaptopurine used to treat leukemia. Thioguanine is still on the World Health Organization's list of essential medicines. Her team also developed pyrimethamine, a malaria treatment, and allopurinol, used to treat gout. Another of Ellion's drugs, azathioprine, works to stop the immune system from rejecting new organs. Without it, there could be no transplant surgery. If that wasn't enough, in 1977, her team's discoveries were adapted to create Acyclovir, the first effective treatment against the herpes virus. At one stage in her early years at Wellcome, Ellion was faced with a very tough choice. She was told that if she wanted to complete her PhD, she would have to quit work and study full-time. She opted to drop her studies and stay at the lab, a difficult decision at a time when female scientists were often considered inferior to male ones. Quote, years later, when I received 3 honorary doctorate degrees from George Washington University, Brown University, and the University of Michigan, I decided that perhaps that decision had been the right one after all. End of quote, she observed wryly at the time of accepting her Nobel Prize. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia, Incorporated. It has been a long-standing practice of these broadcasts to finish off with something humorous, and today's jokes have been sent by Ken, VK3CEK. Our jokes this month come from long-time RAT supporter Ken, VK3CEK, and he assures me that these are genuine, taken down word for word as they were uttered during various trials in America, later published by court reporters. Attorney, what was the first thing your husband said to you that morning? Witness, he said, "Where am I, Kathy?" Attorney, and why did that upset you? Witness, "My name is Susan." Attorney, what gear were you in at the moment of the impact? Witness, Gucci sweats and Reeboks. Attorney, are you sexually active? Witness, no, I just lie there. Attorney, what is your date of birth? Witness, July the 18th. Attorney, what year? Witness, every year. Attorney, how old is your son, the one living with you? Witness, 38 or 35, I can't remember which. Attorney, how long has he lived with you? Witness, 45 years. Attorney, now doctor, isn't it true that when a person dies in his sleep, he doesn't know about it until next morning? Witness, did you actually pass the bar exam? Attorney, how was your first marriage terminated? Witness, by death. Attorney, and by whose death was it terminated? Witness, take a guess. Attorney, can you describe the individual? Witness, he was about medium height and had a beard. Attorney, was this a male or a female? Witness, unless the circus was in town, I'm going with male. Attorney, do you recall the time that you examined the body? Witness, the autopsy started around 8:30 p.m. Attorney, and Mr. Denton was dead at the time? Witness, if not, he was by the time I finished. Thank you for listening. This concludes our session for this month. We shall be back with you on Monday, the 2nd of July, 2018. Until then, keep well and smiling, and a final reminder of those in the 40 and 20 metre callbacks to give us your opinion, please, on the continuation of the HF relay of this broadcast. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia, saying 73 and listening now for any check-ins and callbacks.